This is a FUBAR Radio podcast. Go to FUBARradio.com for more details. Mark Dolan eats the news on FUBAR Radio.
I'll stop that. Oh my God, it's impossible not to sing along to that tune. John Farnham, you're the voice on FUBAR Radio. What a triumphant anthem to start the day, the show, the year somehow. It's still January. We're talking New Year's resolutions and much, much more. Yes, indeed. A great tune on a great radio station. It's FUBAR Radio with you 24 hours a day. The UK's largest ad-free online radio station. And we're here to do this.
Mark Dolan eats the news on FUBAR Radio.
Now, we've got so much to get through, but at 12:05 on a Thursday, let's remember the incredible icon, the puzzling enigma wrapped in a confusing triangle of what the hell, the one and only David Bowie. What a legend. He's an iconic British man. And we'll be talking about Britishness later. Is it time to have an English national anthem? We're also asking what New Year's resolutions have already imploded for you. And a quick question, just what is it that women actually want? This is FUBAR. But first, we're going to kick off with a rant, something I feel quite passionate about. Here we go. It's this. I am doing Wet January this year. Yes, you heard it here first. Barely have I recovered from my overdose of turkey and Sainsbury's Taste the Difference Rioja than I'm invited via Twitter, Facebook, and my rather patronising neighbour Ian to do Dry January. A challenge to give up alcohol, yes, for the month of January. Now, I'd like you to know I won't be doing this. Quite the opposite. This very day, I'm expecting a particularly alcohol-filled Ocado order. Normally, I put some food items in the order. Spinach, porridge oats, quinoa. Just to make my lifestyle look less dysfunctional to the Ocado man. But not this time. This time, the poor chap will need to double up all the bags. Such will be the glassy weight of wines, beers and spirits he's forced to carry into my home. I am not, I repeat, not doing Dry January. In fact, I'm going to drink more in January to send out my own message, which is that 2016 should be the swan song of days, weeks and months of the year being appropriated for awareness of this cause or that. Given that there are just 365 days in the year, there are a finite number of causes or issues we can be made aware of on a daily basis. In fact, I'm overly aware these days. I have awareness fatigue. I could do with a few days of being unaware. I'm sure I'd sleep better. Here are just a few of the up-and-coming special days in the next few months. National Doodle Day. National Old Stuff Day. World Thinking Day. I might give that one a go. Winnie the Pooh Day, obviously. And my personal favourite, Squirrel Appreciation Day. Yes, that is actually a thing. While we're at it, March is National Bed Month. Good luck selling that one to your boss. Now, where does this end? Well, perhaps we should have World Bathroom Tile Day. They're great, aren't they? Bathroom tiles! Very rarely appreciated for the work they do keeping water and condensation off our walls as we bathe. Or how about National No Left Turn Signs Appreciation Month? After all, think of the carnage if those bad boys didn't exist. I'm amazed a ballsy charity haven't decided to up the ante and take a whole year. Or how about people who wear glasses decade? I like the sound of that one, though. Maybe a little short-sighted. Look, here's what I'm saying. The calendar is a sacred thing, and a day in the year should never be the commercial and intellectual property of any organisation, however well-intended its aims are. Ultimately, it just becomes a PR battle with lesser-known causes falling by the wayside. There are other vested interests at work, too. Government departments often chip in, and of course, big business is always happy to ally itself to virtuous causes. For them, charity always begins at home. And this is what grinds my gears. Even worse than being told that a week next Tuesday I have to worry about bowel complaints is being told when to drink, when not to, when to do a triathlon, when to give up meat, when to sleep outdoors overnight, when to wear a onesie to work. Actually, I am wearing a onesie to work today. As we speak, I'm a vision in leopard print polyester. But in my view, these jolly japes we have to participate in, wacky sports, challenges, stunts, use up valuable drinking time and are the worst kind of peer pressure. Dry January has got to be the worst idea ever. And here's the thing, the medical community aren't even agreed on whether the fasting model is necessarily any good for you in the first place. And that makes my mind up for me. I'm not going to disagree with doctors, am I? That would be frankly reckless, and I'd hate to be reckless. So there you have it. I'm not doing Dry January because of the health fears surrounding it. Which means that when I wake up tomorrow morning, the only special cause I'm going to be aware of is my hard-earned hangover, courtesy of my good friend, the Ocado Man. I'll drink to that. You're listening to FUBAR.
Mark Dolan eats the news on FUBAR Radio.
Now, two men before me look like they're doing something akin to a damp January, because it is the top journalist, John Reynolds, and the iconic movie critic from Sky Movies, ITV1, and other premium platforms, Craig Stevens. Boys, welcome to FUBAR Radio. Welcome to Mark Dolan Eats the News.
How are you, sir?
Listen, I'm really, really well. Let me ask you, Craig, where do you stand on days of the week, special months of the year when we've got to, like, not have gluten or eat extra amounts of couscous? What's your view?
I don't understand any of these. Today is National Eat Your Mother's Dinner Day, because let's be honest, we did that for like 15 years until she threw us out. Like, I don't get why we have to celebrate certain days. It is just a marketing thing, right? Surely it's a marketing thing. It's like, let's buy cashew nuts day. Really? Because I wanted the pistachios yesterday and now I feel bad. I feel like I'm cheating on the pistachio. Maybe I shouldn't have done that. So I don't get it. I don't understand. It's purely, it's like the whole, and I don't want to be unromantic, it's like Valentine's Day. Mm-hmm. Someone just went, hang on a minute, I've got a great idea. We need to flog a few of these shitty little cards we've got left over from Christmas. Let's wrap a heart round the robin and we'll flog it 2 months later. That's kind of what we've done, right? And now we've all bought into that. I disagree with any national day.
Right, okay. Now,
sorry, John, I didn't mean to rant then, but that's basically
where do you stand on this? Because as an accomplished journalist, in a way, it's great column inches for you guys,
sure,
isn't it? You know,
yeah,
because every time there's an awareness about this or that, yeah, there's 400 words written for you.
I think with dry January, I mean, that has become part of the fabric now. I guess it would be one way to move it on, or one way where it sort of establish itself even better would be maybe the money saved on people not spending on alcohol to put it to some sort of charitable cause or something like that.
Or yeah, cigarettes.
Or cigarettes.
Or cigarettes. Or cigarettes, yeah.
I mean, my thing is, in particular, looking at dry January, it's clear that we have, as a nation, a cultural problem with alcohol, don't we? We sort of tend to binge drink, and you know, we look at how the Italians and the French do it with envy, because it just seems like it's integrated in the context of food and friendship and socialising, whereas for us it's like we seem to just drink for the effect.
I can't work out though quite really whether it is just an advert of how much of piss heads are we if we have to take a month off.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, that's it. It's basically an advert going, hang on, we've all messed ourselves up for like 11 months, we should probably take a rest. The problem that I have with dry January is not necessarily, I like, if you want to kind of stop drinking, that's great. If you want to be healthier, I love all that. Like, we all join a gym for about an hour in early January, don't we? And then we realise it's really busy and we're not going to go back. But if you have to give up alcohol, is that not bad for the liver? Like, if you have become kind of not immune to it, but if you're doing it every day of every month up until January, and then suddenly your body goes, hang on a minute, I'm craving, I'm in real pain.
I guess
is
most,
that dangerous?
Most sensible people would sort of, you know, not have alcohol for 1 or 2 days a week just to give the liver a rest, wouldn't they? I would have thought. Really.
Well, then this is my sort of argument. What I'm gunning for is 3 days on, 4 days off, just as a thing.
Yeah.
What
is
do you
that
reckon?
Just like in life in general?
Yes.
It's nothing to do with alcohol, is it? It's just basically, yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
I mean, it's we are sort of strange. The French, the Italian, they don't need dry January, do they? You know, it is a sort of, and I just wonder also whether this fasting for a month, it actually fits with the spirit of binge drinking, because it is about all or nothing, and we surely need to get away from that rather than encourage it.
I think binge drinking, the problem is that we do this thing where we go, it's the weekend, we must get hammered. Because let's be honest, the majority of us have jobs where we can't really turn up drunk. It's frowned upon.
You work in the media, it's expected.
It's expected in the media, but I was trying to be one of the people. But so I think if you turn up on it, you know, so Friday we just go, we've got to let loose, and we want to have alcohol. We want to consume as much as humanly possible. My problem is, and I don't know how you guys are with this, I have the worst hangovers in the world.
Okay.
So I cannot do 2 nights in a row, because if I have 3 drinks or 15 drinks, I'm still just as a mess the next day. So Saturday is a horrible day for me. So Sunday might be the first time I actually think I would quite like a drink with maybe dinner again.
So you're one of those lucky people who can't really drink.
No, it's a nightmare for me. I have to really forward think.
But I think I always think that's a blessing, because I sort of observe people who drink too much, and they're generally the ones whose bodies tolerate alcohol quite well, which would appear on the face of it a gift, but in fact is a curse. I mean, you're a journalist, John. So, I mean, you sort of, the drinking culture
certainly in the 70s, 80s, it was very boozy, wasn't it, on Fleet Street?
It's frowned upon now, though. Back then, there was sort of, you know, people drinking during lunch hours, drinking in the afternoon, and there were different hours. But now, I mean, I guess the whole... people are deskbound, basically, now. They don't get a chance to go out to the pub as the ones did, basically.
I mean, how much... is this a personal question to ask? How much do we all drink a week?
That's a really good question.
Can we ask... is that okay? John, how much?
I reckon on average about half a bottle of wine every 2 days.
Okay, well, that doesn't sound like a massive amount to me.
No, and I've sort of been through it, and I suspect that the 21 units across the week is something I very rarely hit. Because my approach, which I guess in some ways is symptomatic of the British mentality, which is I do just stay away from it on certain days of the week, and then... on a Friday, if I haven't got a lot going on the next day, or then I'll just think, okay, I'll relax and I'll have a couple of drinks, you know. It probably adds up to somewhere between 15 and 20 units a week, all in, max, except unless it's December.
And then that's
in a day.
Because you'll take the month
off. Well, because it's the Christmas party season, isn't it? And it's just a crazy time.
That's the problem. I think that's the only reason why we even consider Dry January. Because we all kind of do that thing with the works Christmas party, where it's an excuse to chat with the girl in accounts. And let's be honest, if you've had a couple of drinks, you're more likely to talk to the girl from accounts, let's be honest. Because she can move the decimal point on your wages in a much better direction if you do chat her up.
I mean, I'm just playing devil's advocate for a moment, having just ranted about Dry January. I do wonder whether... what it could do is kickstart a cultural sort of sea change in our relationship with alcohol, that actually when people do give up for a month, they start to feel better and maybe don't fancy drinking. Because I don't know if you've ever had this, John, but if you go for a stint of abstinence, let's say a month or two, I do find alcohol tastes, well, it doesn't taste great when you've had a break from it. You know, you sort of have a beer and you're like, this is just... all I can taste is alcohol, you know, that rather than being seduced into the flavours and the hops and all that other stuff.
It could be a good mechanism to wean people off alcohol altogether, then.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, because it is a problem. I mean, it costs the NHS, alcohol-related diseases, it costs us billions, doesn't it, a year?
Yeah.
You know, which is rubbish. And I mean, so do you, John, do you give anything up? Are you an abstinent guy? For example, because this is the day, apparently, when most New Year's resolutions implode.
I was going to say, this is supposed to be the day we all give up on those. Yeah, it was a really good idea not to chat up your wife's sister.
I get the feeling John is one of those really healthy, clean living guys that doesn't need to give anything up. You probably have to take up being a bad boy.
I've curtailed the smoking. I have curtailed the smoking. That's the thing. I've curtailed the smoking just to one or two cigarettes a day.
Now that's good.
That's impressive.
It's still early in January, though, isn't it? I guess.
When did this start? 1st of January.
1st of January.
So two weeks, maybe. Two cigarettes a day.
Yeah.
Can I just ask a question? Did you do this again last January?
Yeah, the same thing happened. I went back to smoking 10 a day, sort of mid January.
Can we go on to the subject of smoking just very quickly,
please?
You know the electric cigarettes. Are you allowed to smoke those in cinemas?
Never tried it.
Well,
okay. I'm sure you'd be
against it. I was doing a show in a comedy club, and there was a guy vaping in the front row, and it was like a sort of gaseous heckle.
Yeah. Yes. You know, it's a weird thing.
The problem with them is that they do still produce a smoke.
Yeah.
You know, admittedly, I think it's a sort of steam vapor. But there's still a cloud of something.
There's still a cloud of something. And it wasn't necessarily the smell that annoyed me. It was just the fact this thing lit up from this guy. I went to a cinema with, like, real people in it and everything. And it was like, really? This is what people... I know. It was really weird. I missed the screening.
Did you go in with personal security?
No, I just snuck in afterwards. I thought no one will know. And I watched the movie, and then someone was just smoking near the front. I kept seeing this smoke, thinking, oh, my God, the cinema's going to catch light. Someone's freaking... what the hell's going on in here? And I realised someone was smoking.
You can see that that actually vaping is now becoming persona non grata. It has been banned on English railways. So you can't do it on the train anymore.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, on the train and also even on railway platforms, vaping is now not allowed.
Mm.
And I think that when that happens, then that's a sea change where I think we'll be frowned upon, because you're still imbibing nicotine, which is a highly addictive substance. Sure. It's not absolutely clear that these vaping sticks are... I mean, clearly they're not as hazardous. I'll stick my neck out. They're not as hazardous.
I guess there's not a flame at the end of your lips anymore.
Correct.
So that's got to be a slight bonus. But I don't know. I was just kind of wondering, because I was thinking, you know, John was saying he's giving up smoking or cut down smoking, which is a great thing. This is a really good thing for health wise.
Yeah.
But
I tell you what I'm interested in is the state possibly offering people help in order to get to drink less, to have less cigarettes, whatever it is, to eat less food, or the wrong food. There isn't an awful lot of public investment or indeed incentivizing of us to live more cleanly, is there?
Does not know. And then I guess the argument is, if they do that, there's too much of a nanny state, basically, if they're offering incentives and subsidies on food and drink like that. Yeah. People don't like it, do they?
It also ties in with the idea of a sugar tax on fizzy drinks, doesn't it? It's all the same sort of moral argument, which is, to what extent are we responsible?
Personal responsibility at the end of the
day.
And
to what extent is it nasty big business who are manipulating us into consuming these products?
I think there's a happy medium, isn't there? I think there's an element of personal responsibility. Like-minded, you know, well-meaning people should really think about, you know, taking personal responsibility. Responsibility of their own health, I would have thought.
Have you read the Alan Carr book, The Easy Way to Stop Smoking?
I should do that.
Because that is a book I would recommend. There isn't anybody I've met who hasn't read the book who then quit. This guy, sadly no longer with us. He died to lung cancer, so he's something of a smoking martyr. And he's sold in excess of 7 million copies of his book. That many people can't be wrong. And for a while, I actually argued that that book should be available for free on the NHS.
I think it's a Bob Monkhouse joke, but he said to stop smoking in bed, you just get a waterbed, fill it with petrol, and that will really, really help.
Dear, dear.
God bless him.
Bob Monkhouse, legend.
The legend
that was. You're listening to this.
Nolan eats the news on FUBAR Radio.
Now let's move on, because I want to ask a simple question today on the show, which is Noel Edmonds right? I don't just mean
about what
generally
in life.
is he right to have that facial hair? Is he right to have highlights at his age?
Can I ask, is that his own hair?
Like,
has anyone proved it?
He's got his own barnet, but what he's chosen to do with his barnet is a source of consternation.
I love a quiff, as you can see.
I can see that.
Yeah, you know
you're
I love a quiff.
You're upstanding as we speak.
Thank you, God bless you, sir. It's because you're both very handsome men. But I've met Noel. Like, he's made me a cup of tea. It's like having a cup of tea from Frodo.
I would have said so.
Why was he making
you tea? Was he grooming
you?
We got an exclusive?
We were both in a kitchen. It was awkward. Noel, hi. He was like, I have no idea who you are. And then he was looking up at me.
It's a nice opening line.
What's it like up there? And he was standing by the kettle. He was making his own tea.
All right.
And at that point, I thought, this is a photo opportunity that I can't get. It's just the two of us in a kitchen. And he said, would you like one? I thought, I can't turn that down. And it was in a Deal or No Deal mug.
Yeah, and that's quite something. And when he made you the coffee, did you say, can I swap it for a tea?
I didn't, because I'd never seen the show at that point.
Okay. Did you say, I like your kitchen. Is it a good kitchen for a house party?
Oh, if this was 1984, that would have really been brilliant.
You just said, I'm forgive my physique, I know I'm tall, but I've put on a little weight. I'm a little blobby at the moment.
Amazing.
Now tell me this.
If he ever makes me another cup of tea, I'm using all three of those.
All of those are yours. Noel Edmonds is in the news this week. The Deal or No Deal host has been criticised on Twitter, which obviously doesn't take a lot, after suggesting migrants were to blame for a traffic jam that he was in. The 67-year-old tweeted to his 11,000 followers. He should have more than that.
Yeah.
I think Noel is at least 200K, I would say.
I mean, he's got to have had more than that turn up on Deal or No Deal over the last 10 years, right?
Well, easily. It's a very good point, by the way. He's got to have made a cup of tea in a kitchen for more people.
For more people than that. I think this, because this was early Deal or No Deal, and it was in Bristol. Where they filmed the show.
Well, were you on like Celebrity Deal or No
Deal? I was on his Your First Show, Craig, Don't Ruin It. And it just happened to be in the same building as Deal or No Deal. We wandered into the kitchen. It's not like we hang out, etc., etc. I have got a really good Noel Edmonds story, but I don't know if it's broadcastable.
Well, it is.
I don't know if it is. There's people just going, yes, it is.
No, they are.
Can we talk about it during the next record?
The nature of FUBAR. All right, you need to stay tuned to Mark Dolan Eats the News for what is probably a live story about Noel Edmonds. But don't worry, it's not like he's very, very rich, powerful, and litigious.
There's only 11,000 people that are likely to tweet me about it.
We'll discuss that. He tweeted to his 11,000 followers, he should have more. Just tried to get somewhere, allowed loads of time, but abandoned journey. Am I alone in feeling Britain is full? Now, He followed it up by saying, just supposing, I know it's a ridiculous thought, crazy even, totally insane obviously, but supposing the UK is full. Now, I'm going to jump straight in and say that Noel Edmonds, the esteemed broadcaster, has made no remarks about migrants, about foreigners, about the colour of people's skin, their religion, culture, anything. I think, to second guess what Noel is saying, he's just talking about numbers of human beings on our islands. John Reynolds, is Britain full?
Yeah, I think in hindsight, Noel should have used a 10-second Twitter rule, basically. So once you're going to tweet something, just hold back for 10 seconds and see if you get a backlash or not. A massive backlash. The only person who's actually endorsed him or actually followed up with a positive comment was, interestingly enough, was Duncan Bannatyne. Actually said, I agreed, Noel, with your comment.
It's another celebrity with strange hair.
Yeah, there could be something in there.
So it might be a hair thing.
But we're not full, are we? I mean, let's be honest. I mean, in parts of the country, I guess if you have a busy day and you're particularly frantic and you can sort of come out and just tweet something ridiculous like that. But, I mean, it's an absurd comment to make. And he's had a massive negative backlash, which I guess is, you know, he deserves.
I think the problem is, I know he's your bestie, so I better be careful, Craig.
Yeah. But one cup of tea doesn't make a lifelong friendship. Mark, as we well know.
As we well know. Here's the thing. He might not have been making a remark which was in any way xenophobic, but that, of course, is the implication. If you say Britain's full, the implication is we don't want any more people coming here. People that come here tend to be non-Brits, and therefore it is potentially perceived as xenophobic.
I mean, having a three-minute cup of tea with a fella doesn't make us mean knowledgeable about
his awareness. Did he say the kitchen was full? Did he say, look, there's not really enough?
He said there's a lot of cups here, but he wasn't eliminating any from colour, creed or material. I think genuinely, and again, I know him from Deal or No Deal, that's about it. I don't think he meant anything by this other than it's a bit bloody busy, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I think it's a bad choice of words.
Are you sure?
I don't know.
I hate disagreeing with you.
I know you do.
Because we've been lovers.
Spare room, your room. It's always been awkward.
That's what it is. That's what Nigel Farage would say, John.
It would be.
But I don't know whether he... You know what it's like? You make that... As John just said, you know, the 10-second Twitter rule didn't apply here. He's gone, it's a bit busy. Isn't Britain busy? Isn't it full? I don't know whether... I mean, I took it to mean exactly what I think the most of the country took it to mean to start with. But having reread it, I'm not convinced he meant it that way. I could be... Yeah. I think there could be another
argument, John Reynolds, which is maybe London is full.
Yeah, that's a good argument. And he also followed it up, Noel, by saying he just wanted to provoke some sort of debate. So maybe it's basically down to his career, maybe, partly being on the skids, on the slide, and he wants to get back into public consciousness by, you know... And he's got publicity.
So you think this was a very well-thought-out tweet?
Yeah, conniving,
actually.
Maybe.
That's interesting.
It's like a few things that he's doing at the moment. He's tweeting quite controversially. He's making constant cups of tea for people.
I mean, that was the real telltale sign for me.
And he does it very publicly, because he live tweets a lot of the time. He's like, kettle's nearly boiled now.
Yeah. There's a tall, skinny fella that looks like Gandalf in the room. I better make him one.
Well, I'm curious of what you think. Is Britain full at FUBAR Radio? I read a very interesting statistic about whether Britain is full or not on a very geographical level, and it's an astonishing fact, which is the United Kingdom is 11% urban, 89% rural.
Yeah. Well, there you go. I mean, I think someone actually tweeted Noel back with a photograph of the countryside as they were on a train going, it's pretty empty here, buddy. And then other people were tweeting going, I think you'll find this might be rush hour. You know, so I don't know. If he did mean it the way it comes across, then shame on him. If he didn't, then think through your tweets. 10-second rule by John, I think.
10-second rule has to be done.
10-second rule, John.
Yep. It's 12:28, and this is FUBAR.
Mark Dolan eats the news on FUBAR Radio.
Now, a sincere happy birthday is in order for the oldest man in the world, 131 years of age, a father of three, with a wife aged 62. I mean, that's borderline inappropriate, isn't it? Yes, civil servants in Brazil say they've discovered the world's oldest person. The father of three, living with a wife of 69 years his junior. The Guinness Book of Records recognises 112-year-old Yasutaro Koide from Japan as the oldest person alive, and Frenchwoman Jeanne Calme, who died aged 122 in 1997. But this chap looks to have taken the biscuit. So here's the question for both of you gentlemen. Who would live in the studio to 131. I mean, the good news on the plus side is that by the time you're at the very end of your life, you'll have the most amazing iPhone. Like the iPhone 77.
Yeah.
So that will be... So I'm certainly willing to...
It's probably got a built-in life support.
Just inevitably. So I probably would like to stick around just so I can have a better smartphone. But apart from that, I can't really see the advantages of living... Because there is a theory that our generation will live to 100 on average. Yeah. And that our children's generation will be living to 110.
I do think if he's 131, it does say here that he's got a wife of 62. That might be why he's still going.
Of course he
is.
You
know what I mean? He's like, hey, you see what I got? Half my age. Give or take, I haven't worked that out correctly, quite right. But you get the idea. I don't know. What are we going to do when you're 131? And you're like, oh, what should I do this morning other than not die? What should I do?
Yes.
I might go to the shops, but that takes me a month. No, I'll stay in bed. What would you do? Because just because your mind might still be functioning and your body parts are still in order at 131 doesn't mean you can still... My back goes out more than I do and I'm like, what, 34? So I don't know really whether we would want to live to that age.
Well, that's right. I mean, certainly, you know, in the last century, the life expectancy in many territories across Western Europe was 30, 40, 50 years of age. Now we live to 70, 80, 90. But isn't it an advantage or is it actually a disadvantage?
I guess it's all to do with quality of life, doesn't it? As Craig says, if your mind's still functioning, you're still active, then it's fine, isn't it? But if you're deteriorating... Then, I mean, if you're 131, I mean, he sounds like a one-off, doesn't he? He won't have any. Has he got any peers or anyone to talk to, or is he just hanging around with people of a generation younger than him, basically?
I mean, that's the other thing. You may, like, we can all sit around and talk about music, for example. He's sitting there going, oh, I remember my first album. I'm so sorry. None of us remember your first album.
Yes.
You know what I mean? We can't have that. Oh, I was watching that on the telly. None of us have ever seen that show. You know what I mean? What were you going to have? Who's he got anything in common with? Remember back in the day? Nope. None of us were born, buddy. Who's he going to relate to?
It's a very good point.
I think we could tap into his knowledge because there are certain cultures, in particular the Chinese, who really revere older people. I wonder whether the very nature of this argument that you don't want to live too long is very British. Because we live in quite an ageist society where we generally perceive that once you're a certain age, you sort of don't really exist anymore and you're just a headache for the next generation.
But would that change if we all live to that age? Do you know what I mean? If society starts to become 100, if we all start to live to 100, would that start to change? Would perception of older people start to change? Like, I know what you're saying, but... Maybe we would be more accepted as an older generation when we get to 100.
Yeah, it's a really interesting debate. And the other issue in terms of the government's finances and our general well-being as a nation is that if we start living to 100, who's going to pay for it?
I was going to say, my pension is pretty... I don't have one. I think when I get to 60, I'm going to struggle.
Listen, your pension is your face, honey. And it's gold-plated from where I'm sitting.
That's an endorsement.
And you're very lucky because you, John, can write until you pop your clogs. I mean, you could get on the dictation machine. Okay,
awkward.
Dictation.
Hashtag awkward. Okay, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to press you both for a correct age at which you'd like to see out your final days. Mm-hmm. What do you reckon? Let's put a figure on it.
Forever.
You're quite rock and roll, Craig. I think you're like... I think you're thinking 39 and a half.
I think a good age to go would probably be 80, mid-80s.
80 sounds good.
I think 80 would be all right. Me and John, me and John in a little home together, chatting about the good times when we're 80.
I've got to say, I would like to live as long as humanly possible, as long as my brain is in order. Yeah. Now, those close to me will question whether that has already happened. But... Seriously, I think that as long as I've got my brain, I could be sat in a chair motionless. But if my brain, if I can read a newspaper and think about what's going on in the world, if I can have Craig Stevens, who's about 7 years younger than me, bring me a cup of tea every so often.
Me or Noel.
Noel Edmonds will do it. But I've got to say that whenever there's a, I think a lot of people would feel this, if you have a mental ailment, then I'm out.
Yeah,
I'm out of here, you know. And I must say, and it is slightly topical, this issue, not only because they've discovered this oldest man in the world, but David Bowie, actually, without being sort of corny about it, a lot of people have said, you know, his death was like his life. It was a work of art. the poor man knew that he was seriously ill. He wrote and recorded an album which contained themes of mortality. The video to his last single features him in a hospital bed with bandages. So obviously he knew what was happening, sending us a message from up above. But if you look at someone like Bowie, I mean, it's tragic that he's gone so young. He wasn't even 70. But maybe it's also perfect, too, that we never had to see Bowie, you know, just sort of old and ragged and embarrassing. And do you know what I mean? Mm. Just with a drip being followed by a nurse. You sort of think this guy, you know, he got out at the top.
I think that's an interesting point, because we want that from our idols. We don't want to see our idols fall. Of course we don't. But then him as a human being with a family is a different story. You know, they want to be with him for as long as possible. So that's the awkward thing. It's that I'm a huge Michael Jackson fan, as you well know, and I've seen Help for it and everything. But I didn't want to see someone like Michael Jackson start to make bad music or just start doing something for the wrong reason. I want that enigma. I want that mystery.
I think if you
Google
Michael Jackson, I think it did do a lot of things for the
wrong. Don't make me come over the other side
reasons.
Of the day. Yeah, yeah. I picked a bad one to bring up for an analogy here. But I like the idea that, like you say, we don't see him as an old man not being able to function, not like, you know, if Michael couldn't moonwalk, like, really?
Well, you sort of do wonder about some of these icons. You look at John Lennon, God rest his soul, you know, taken terribly young from us, but he has become a legend, and we've sort of watched Paul McCartney sort of get a bit jowly, release
that's a perfect example,
some pretty divisive music in terms of critical acclaim, and have various different shades of brown hair. So, you know, you sort of think in some ways when you're an artistic icon, you
but
want
then,
to get out early.
To be fair, David Bowie's music, his music didn't really taper off. It's always been a good quality, hasn't it? I think he had his lean period maybe in the 80s when he got a bit misguided. But I think in the 90s and in the early noughties, his music was as good as it was in the 70s.
What would you say, in terms of the 80s, what would you say? Was it like the Let's Dance album or which particular?
What was the duet he did with Mick Jagger? What was that? That was
Dancing on the Street.
Dancing on the Street.
Yeah, that wasn't ideal, was it? No. You would have thought between them they could have maybe come up with their own song.
But what's really weird about that is then it becomes one of the most played songs on radio.
Yeah, true.
That's what's weird about this. The songs that people love these people for, the songs that we grow up going, oh my God, that's an incredible piece of work, are not the songs that ever got mass radio play and got to number one. Stevie Wonder, I Just Called to Say I Love You is one of the worst songs ever made by the legend that is Stevie Wonder. And yet that song gets to number one in the UK. Really?
Yeah.
Superstition doesn't?
Paul
come
McCartney,
on, what's wrong with the plan?
Pipes Apiece was one of the long, most enduring number ones in English music history. You know, and this is the guy that wrote Let It Be. It's very intriguing.
What's wrong with the world?
It's crazy. Interesting stuff. Well, you're listening to FUBAR Radio. It's 12:37. Don't go anywhere, because after this, we'll be talking about whether or not you can have an amicable breakup in the light of Gary Lineker divorcing his lovely wife, and also just what is it that females actually want. This is FUBAR.
You feel for a golden girl knows when he's kissed her.
woman had a set of lungs. Shirley Bassey, Goldfinger. You're listening to FUBAR Radio.
Presents The Friday Social with Hugh Joseph and Michael Payne.
Monty the Bear, congratulations on landing a role in a big feature film. That's a big thing. But what about these allegations that apparently you bummed Leonardo DiCaprio on set?
Hey, man, I'll be honest with you, man. Leo's probably a bit embarrassed that, me and him got it on. I'm a gay bear, I'm a gay bear. I'm proud to admit I'm a gay bear.
That's good. Is there a lot of...
I'm a gay ass bear.
Is there a lot of gay bears, or are you a lonely gay bear?
I'm the only gay bear in the forest, man.
Every Friday.
The Friday Social with Hugh Joseph and Michael Payne.
From 1 p.m. on FUBAR Radio. Mark Dolan eats the news on FUBAR Radio.
So the headline is, we've had 8 wonderful years together. That's not Sky Movies' Craig Stevens and I, although we have.
We have had 8 wonderful years, haven't we? It's about 8 now.
Just a bit.
And they've all been wonderful.
Well, they have. It's flown by.
Hasn't it?
Hasn't it, then?
It's been the off odd. I think every other year has been awkward.
Well, we've never had a split, unlike sport icon...
Good link.
Gary Lineker. Yes, indeed. Gary and Danielle Lineker say they are still friends, as he is seen for the first time since revealing that they divorced. The football pundit, former England and, of course, Tottenham Hotspur legend. Hashtag just saying. He and this young lady, she's a Welsh model, a very fine-looking lady, have split after 6 years of marriage. They married in Italy in 2009, were granted a decree nisi. I don't know, is that an honorary degree?
Is that
from the University of Leicester?
What is that? Yeah.
Divorce said to be fueled by Danielle's desire to start a family, while father of four, Gary, allegedly didn't want more children. I'm completely hear where you're coming from on that. Gary. Spokesperson told Mail Online they remain the greatest of friends and wish each other every happiness. The pair took to Twitter, as you do, to confirm the news, revealing they're grateful for the many wonderful years they spent together. Here's the question, Craig. Is it possible to have an amicable split? Is this just PR spin?
Ask me again in about 6 months' time.
Well, I know that you yourself have had one or two, marital challenges.
Yes.
And therefore, this is not an alien story to you.
This is, the reason for divorce is slightly different, but it's, the reality is still the same. And being amicable, if you already have children together, mm-hmm. I think being as amicable as possible is very, very important. Not necessarily just for the relationship, but for the child involved.
Yes.
So I get it, but how amicable? I think it's one of those things that you say as a person. You sort of go like, we're very amicable, but that doesn't stop the under the breath. As these things are happening. So I think it's very difficult to be amicable. I think it will be rare to see them hanging out as bezzy mates.
Yes.
In 6 months' time. And I don't think it'll be long before we see either one of them in a newspaper with a premiere or with someone else. But I don't know if amicable is a word that other than no, we don't hate each other. We're splitting for because we want different things in life. But I think amicable is a very loose term for what probably they're really thinking.
Isn't there something quite attractive, idea, John, about the idea of a passionate, tempestuous relationship that was so charged with love and kinetic and sexual energy and all the rest of it? Just this amazing, like sort of Elizabeth Taylor, Richard Burton thing. This idea of love that you either... you're just full on, or you can't be in the same room. That's the sort of romantic idea of love. Does anyone buy this rather sort of anodyne, sort of Gwyneth Paltrow, sort of consciously decoupling nonsense?
No, probably not. The interesting thing about this, though, you can see Lineker has got some rationale, because he's 55 now. If he has children now, when they're in their schooling years, he'll be, what, 70s and things like that?
Yeah.
It's probably not ideal. And the other thing worth mentioning about this is that it maybe is amicable, because they've not been arguing over the divorce courts. They had a quickie divorce. They did it online, didn't they? They paid something like £300. So there's no grappling over who owns what and houses like that. So maybe there is.
Well, I've got to grill you in a kind of slightly sort of journo way now. Do we know whether there's a prenup or anything? Do you think they had a prenup? What do we think?
I don't honestly know, is the short answer. I would have thought so.
Shall we speculate, Craig?
Here's the thing.
It's going to have been expensive for Gaz, whatever happens, surely.
Yesterday was a bad day for Gary Lineker. Let's imagine this is you and I, right? We were married.
Nice.
You're quite...
Very 2015.
You're quite well
16.
Off. 16. You're quite well off.
I try.
You're doing all right. I, on the other hand, you know, I'm trying. We split, or we get married, would you allow me, knowing that I want you for, let's be honest, your charm, your fame, your money, would you make me sign a prenup?
I don't think you can. I think the whole point about marriage is, on the day that you get married, it's a total commitment.
I agree.
And if there's a prenup, that's not a commitment. That's a commitment with an asterisk,
isn't it? Yeah, it's a no. I'm up for this, but once the, you know, the OK magazine deal goes, we, you know, this isn't going to be the same. I think you can't have a prenup. I don't think they had a prenup. I don't think many people now can have prenup. Although I think, isn't Cheryl Cole, Vanessa to the nearest decimal point or whatever she's called now, I think she, from what I understand, she has a prenup.
Right, okay, yeah.
Which but I wonder
was
if
probably
that's,
very wise.
But I don't think these two did. I got the feeling from when you did see them at things, they looked like a couple.
Genuine in love, yeah.
Well, look,
yeah.
You know, we wish them both well. He's a total English sporting legend.
And
she's a lovely, beautiful lady. And then good luck to them, you know. Of course, they're human beings trying to do the best they can. One question I would ask in a more general sense is, friendship with your ex, is it a goer? Is it even a good idea, or should you just walk away? I mean, John...
It's a good idea if you've got kids, isn't
it? We don't really have time in the show to go through all of your exes. Well, maybe just to save time, we'll get, so
5 minutes.
We'll get alphabetical.
We'll start with A.
But... You know, I suppose it's a little bit of a when Harry met Sally question, you know, which is, can you have a platonic friendship with between a male and a female? But an even bigger question is, can you have a platonic friendship with someone that used to be your lover?
I think the crux of it, if there's children and if it's in the best interest of children, I think a couple can overcome any difficulties they've had through a divorce. And, you know, it's in their best interest to carry on and have a amicable relationship going forward. So children is the crux, I would have thought.
Yeah.
I completely agree. Me and my ex are trying desperately to be friends.
What about ex-girlfriends?
Ex-girlfriends, you don't need to worry about them. Unless you've got kids with them, like as John says.
You love them and leave them, really, Stevens.
I don't even know if the word love is in there, really, to be fair. But yeah, with an ex and a child, I think it's really important, as exactly what John says, I think it's really important that you try as hard as possible. I think no one, when you split up, when there's a child involved, plans on having pure hatred for their other half, because it just would make... It would have a massive impact on the child, and I guess that's what, you know, Daniel Lineker and Gary would really not want.
Okay, it's 12:48 on FUBAR Radio. You're listening to Sky Movies and ITV1's Craig Stevens. We have a journalist for all of the key iconic publications, John Reynolds, and me, Mark Dolan.
Mark Dolan eats the news on FUBAR Radio.
While we're on the subject of love, John Reynolds, a simple question for you. Would you marry Rupert Murdoch?
Maybe I would, for his wealth, maybe. It's interesting to see what the age gap between Rupert Murdoch and Jerry Hall is, actually. What is the age?
Yeah, we're 105.
We're going to actually, would you mind, Will, would you mind checking the age gap? My producer, Will's going to have a look at the age gap between Rupert Murdoch and Jerry Hall. It's a few decades. That said, in fairness to him, it's not like she's 23 or something. She's a lady of substance and of a decent age herself. So it's not in that inappropriate area.
I think she's 55.
Yeah.
She's 55 and he's 155.
He's 80s, isn't he?
Is he 80s? I mean, I'll be honest with you. There's a picture in the Mail. I think it's the Mail Online. And he's kissing her and she's just... excuse me. He's kissing her and she's just sort of going, he's dribbling. And I don't know if it's because he fancies me or it's my age. Do you know what I mean? You can't quite tell, but it's not, it just looks a little wrong.
The thing about it is, if you look at the lifestyle of someone like Rupert Murdoch, not only is he an incredibly rich man,
yeah,
and obviously a very clever man, so yeah, these are both attractive qualities to any female. But he's also incredibly fit. I mean, he gets up at something ridiculous like 5 a.m.
And has to go to the bathroom, though.
I think it's to go to...
We've all got a wee as we get older, haven't we?
You know, middle of the night. I think it's to go to the gym. I mean, he is an incredibly driven guy. He has access to some of the most premium Viagra any man could hope to have.
That's a good point.
So I'm sure there are no issues in the bedroom. Look, he's rich and powerful and famous.
And he's
attractive. And he's a one... You know, it was ever thus, wasn't it, John, that a lady will come come running.
But she's wealthy in her own... I don't think she's in it for the money. She's wealthy in her own right, isn't she? And she
has a big house. Because she married Mick Jagger, but then in a territory where it wasn't officially acknowledged. So they weren't technically married, even though she thought she was.
She lives in... They share Jagger's £13 million
mansion. Talk about staying friendly with your ex.
Yeah, well, he obviously doesn't live there, but she's only allowed to live in his £13 million mansion while she's unmarried.
Right.
So as soon as she marries, she's out of that house. I mean, in all fairness to her, if she's going to marry Rupert Murdoch, I don't think she's worried about a £13 million mansion. Let's be honest, that's probably the least of her worries. But it does make you question her level of wealth.
In comparison
to, say, Jagger's and, of course, Rupert Murdoch's.
But she has earned money. She has been the brand ambassador for a number of clothing brands and things like that. I think she's been self-sufficient through the years, I would have thought.
Yeah, I mean, I think what's interesting about this is that he's chosen somebody. He's made a similar decision to Paul McCartney, actually, because Paul McCartney married...
To make bad music?
Well, occasionally. But he married Heather Mills McCartney. Mm-hmm. I think he married for love. I think they fell in love.
Yeah.
That didn't work out, and he had to write quite a big check in order to divorce her. They were not equal. They were not economic equals. Whereas Nancy Chevelle, who is the current Mrs. McCartney, is a woman who, if anything, is even richer than Paul McCartney. Yeah. She's also of a similar age. And what Paul has done is thought, OK, I've got my fingers burnt with a younger woman who is not my economic equal. I can be sure, he can be sure that Nancy Chevelle is not in it for the money.
Yeah.
Similarly, Linda McCartney, the late great Linda McCartney, of course, his first wife, was the heiress to the Kodak fortune, which, of course, now is worth around £11. But in the 1970s...
That's probably because George Michael drove his Range Rover into the only remaining store.
That's it. But in the 70s, Kodak was basically like Apple. It was a huge corporate conglomerate. Yeah. She was a wealthy lady in her own right. So I suppose what we're learning from Rupert here is, similarly, that he's chosen an intelligent woman, a woman of substance. She's not a child. She's 59 years of age. And she's probably got a few quid. So therefore, this is a decision by a man of a certain age to marry across rather than up or down.
I think does it say he's 84?
Yeah, that's
right. He's 84.
To be fair, it would be quite difficult for him to find someone who's his economic equal too, wouldn't it? I would have thought.
Yeah.
And unless it was Warren Buffett and they were going to have a bromance. I paid to see that.
She's always going to get free papers, free Sky. So she hasn't got to worry there. No monthly subscriptions. She'll get Sky
you
movies whenever
that,
she needs it.
The idea of free Sky, you say that through gritted teeth. it's a very sweet thing. And we wish Rupert Murdoch every good fortune in his marriage to Jerry Hall. We love Rupert. After all, he does have an economic involvement with Sky Movies.
He certainly does. God bless him.
And therefore, for the purposes of this show, we love you, Rupert.
Yeah.
I've got some terribly sad news, which Will has just brought in. And it really is
a tragic story.
Absolutely. Alan Rickman, giant of British film and theatre, has died at the age of 69. Which I think is the same age as that of David Bowie, actually.
Bowie, yeah.
Alan Rickman, one of the best loved and most warmly admired British actors of the past 30 years, has died in London, aged 69. His death was confirmed on Thursday by his family. He'd been suffering from cancer. A star whose arch features and languid diction were recognisable across the generations. Rickman found a fresh legion of fans with his role as Professor Snape in the Harry Potter films. Fantastic in those movies. The actor has a big screen staple of hits. So, for example, he was Hans Gruber, Bruce Willis's sardonic adversary in Die Hard. He's a great, great movie star. Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. How lucky are we to have Craig Stevens from Sky Movies here? Alan Rickman, an important British actor.
I mean, Alan Rickman was just... I mean, there wasn't really anything that he couldn't turn his hand to. I mean, it was always really interesting when you mentioned Robin Hood.
Yeah.
You know, the on-set rivalry with Kevin Costner.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, they just had... I think Kevin Costner sort of hated the idea that Alan Rickman was going to be the sheriff. He just felt so under...
He just knew that the movie would be stolen from him. Because wasn't
and it was, wasn't it? I mean, there is nothing he did. I mean, like you say, Harry Potter. When he came as Harry Potter, I was like, Alan Rickman? And, you know, he is Professor Snape.
It's interesting, isn't it? Isn't he in the category of those actors who steal movies and who steal scenes? And it seems to be only a handful of actors who are allowed to sort of steal scenes. You know, you think of someone like maybe in America, Jim Carrey, steals. Peter Sellers, you know, there are a few actors who just who basically sort of just gobble up the scene. And Alan Rickman was one of those, wasn't he?
He was. He had a very small part in, do you remember the Sweeney Todd movie with Johnny Depp?
Right.
He just stole that film. You know, Johnny Depp was great, but Alan Rickman comes in and
swashbuckling. That's a word, isn't it?
Swashbuckling is a great word.
He was. I mean, you get a feeling he just learned his lines, strode on set and just did it.
Wasn't he in Love Actually, too?
Love Actually as well, yeah.
I remember scenes of him in that when he was buying diamonds, when he was buying the ring for his girlfriend. I remember those scenes. They're the only scenes I remember from Love Actually.
And great. He was incredible. I can't believe we've lost him.
Another thing that was special about his contribution is, first of all, his range. So, obviously, great character actor, comedy, drama, you know, sort of sci-fi, everything, horror, fantasy. So lots of range as an actor. But also a star from this country that totally made it in Hollywood.
Yeah, completely.
You know, that this is a guy who directors would say, okay, this film is lacking a certain something, let's get Alan Rickman.
Which I think is exactly what they did in Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. We, you know, when you realise you've got an American Robin Hood, you need to counteract that with some high quality. I mean, you just mentioned like his range as well. You know, he went from, it was quite controversial in 1999, he went from doing Dogma, the Kevin Smith film, which everyone, you know, that was a big uproar of controversy about that film. And then he went straight into doing Galaxy Quest. And if you've seen those two movies, they don't sit side by side, but that's what Alan Rickman can do. You know, the level of quality acting alongside the comedy acting that he brought to it as well.
Well, there you go. He'll be sorely missed, particularly as his on-screen persona always seemed so ebullient and full of life and in a way indestructible.
Yeah. Yeah, he really did, didn't he? What do we know? Why he's lost his life? What was the
cancer? Unfortunately,
it was cancer.
Yeah, which of course affects so many. So there you go. Well, FUBAR Radio, we salute you, Alan Rickman, a legend. And what's wonderful about being a movie star is that his legacy, like David Bowie's, will go on forever.
Yeah.
And we'll all be on Netflix tonight, having a go at Harry Potter and Die Hard and all the rest.
Not
of it.
Not forgetting Lemmy too.
Yeah, Lemmy from Motorhead.
It's
been a shocking year, hasn't it? Let's be honest. There you go. Well, we'll try and end on a high because it's been a real treat to have both of you here today. We have a very funny story. A Good Samaritan buys a McDonald's meal for a homeless man who she saw eating pots of ketchup, only to find out it was an ordinary customer waiting for his order, and he was quite offended. Now, well done, Claire Varin, for being so public-spirited. Little did she know that it was aimed at the wrong person. I can't say I've had a faux pas quite that bad, but I am one of those people that will go into a clothes shop and say, excuse me, have you got this in large, only to discover it's another customer who just happens to be wearing a blue suit. And it's not good, because what you're basically doing is you're taking someone who's probably very accomplished in their life and saying, I think you work in a shop.
The worst thing is when you go into a shop and you want to buy something and you want to check, have you ever done this where they check the size when you're at the counter? They go, oh, you're buying the large shirt, sir.
Oh, yes.
And then it gets to underwear and they're like, and you're buying the extra small pants. Lovely, put those in there. They only do it when there's a freaking queue, don't they?
It's always.
Only when there's a queue.
Have you been a victim of performing a faux pas? I know you're a circumspect man. I know you're circumcised. No, I got the wrong way. Have you been a subject of...
None that springs to mind. I'm sure I will. I'll have to come back to you on that.
Yeah. How many larger ladies have you got off the chair for going, I hope it is a boy, girl? What are you having other than lunch?
The words, when's it due, are the final last words of many a man.
I love the fact now, if you live in London, you have the underground and people have the baby on board badges. Which they were like, you know, which is great because now you can't make that fight. But if you don't have the badge, you don't get the chair.
Absolutely right. Well, all I can say is Craig Stevens from Sky Movies, ITV1, everywhere else, continue being an excellent film critic. And John
you,
Reynolds, we look
Thank
forward
you.
To reading you in a proper newspaper very soon.
The Metro.
This has been Mark Dolan Eats the News.